And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast for Tuesday, September 20th. Derek Van Riper here with Al Melchior. We continue our leaderboard series. This year, taking a look at year-over-year barrel rate movers. So we're looking for the players who have increased their barrel rate or decrease their barrel rate the most from last season to this season. To do that, we use the FanGraphs year-to-year season stats tool. Very interesting tool that Al told me about probably maybe even a year or so ago now at least. So I didn't even know that page existed. So thank you, Al. I've had a lot of fun using that for podcasts and for just personal enjoyment over the time since I've learned about it. We're going to start with the risers, and to set it up, just in case you're looking to replicate this leaderboard, I ended up using 100 plate appearances last year and this year to account for players that might have been injured, but to also dig up some players who might be part-time guys or guys who were part-time players that could have larger roles at some point in the future. But this stat continues to boggle my mind. It is not new to me. I think I've even talked about it on at least one of our podcasts at some point this season. Aaron Judge is the biggest barrel rate riser from last season to this season. He's up at 26.3%. That's a 0.8, or that's an increase of 8.7% from last season's rate. Unbelievable. Of course, the conversations for next year have Aaron Judge in the conversation for the first overall pick. It is deserved. I think it's important when you're looking at any season's worth of results. The most recent season always carries a lot of weight in terms of what players are going to cost on draft day. Recency bias is very real. What do you do with a player like Judge, who was already very good? His last three seasons in barrel rate were 19.7%, 11.4% in the shortened season in 2020, 17.6% last year. Those are great barrel rates. Excellent. Those are among the league leaders each and every year. What the heck do you do when a guy breaks into this whole new level and does what Aaron Judge has done in this historically great season?
Well, I think it depends on what the competition is, who the other contenders are for that first pick overall, and if there were somebody else. Like, you know, the run that Mike Trout had where he was the pretty easy 1-1 for several years in a row. If you have an Aaron Judge season like this in the middle of somebody else having a run like that, it's tempting to go with the recency bias, but it's probably not the smartest thing. But for somebody like Judge, who, I mean, I wouldn't say was necessarily in the conversation, but it wouldn't have surprised anybody for him to at least be in the conversation in any given year, as long as he was healthy. You know, there's nobody else standing out. So I would feel pretty good about just taking the risk that what we see this year is something that Judge can sustain. And something else occurred to me too, DVR, in thinking about that, which is that every podcast episode that we probably ever do, we look at year-to-year trends for players, and we look at players who are having an off year or players who are bouncing back from an off year. And it's always so much easier to find multiple explanations for a bad year than it is a good year. you know, because it's like, you look at Aaron Judge, it's like, well, and you've cited the Chandler rule before. You know, I'll cite it now, that once you demonstrate a skill, you own it. That's you know, that seems really plausible. Oh, this is who Aaron Judge is now. He's broken through. Whereas you look at some of the other seasons and you can blame health or you can blame mechanics or any number of things. So I wish I had a better, you know, sort of set of a better set of tools to diagnose good seasons. So at least I could come with some different explanations.
Yeah, there's a couple things that I think are worth mentioning here, you know, related to this idea. The skills that Judge showed us in 2017 are pretty similar to the skills he's shown in 2022. This is just a better version of that player where the strikeout rate's down, right? Back in 2017, Aaron Judge hit 52 homers, had 9 stolen bases, hit 284 with a 422 OBP. So We've seen a full season with an OPS above 1,000 before. We've seen 50-plus home run power from him before. But he struck out more back then. And the barrel rate was 24.9% that year. That's very close to what he's doing right now. So if you look at 2017 and 2022 together, you say, well, that's more like the high-end range of healthy outcomes for him. And then it's a question of health. How risky are the past injuries that Aaron Judge has had relative to other players in the pool? And, you know, factors like age have to come into consideration too. It's funny you mentioned Trout, because in your mind, at least in my mind, Mike Trout's a lot older than Aaron Judge. But he's not. He's only 7 months older than Aaron Judge, which is just wild. Because he got to the big leagues so young, he's got nearly twice as many career plate appearances at the big league level. I think the other way you could sort of put Judge into a more reasonable context is to just look at his career numbers. What has he been for a slash line for his career? He's been a 284, 393, 584 hitter. That's a great player. 20.5% barrel rate. If you said, DVR, what do you think his projection looks like for next year? I'm going to guess that the projections are going to be right around those numbers, because that's a healthy amount of regression. But when you think about that as a baseline, that's a great projection. That's definitely a player that will draw fair consideration for the first overall pick. I think the biggest knocks on him will be the injury history, possibly changing teams, and speed relative to other elite players. Even though this year, the other thing he's added are more stolen bases. It's hard to do that when you hit for this much power, because you take away stolen base chances by hitting home runs, and you're not on first or second, so, you know, there you go. But he's 16 for 19 as a base stealer. So I think a lot of the negativity, the counter-Judge arguments are going to focus on Judge being a first-time double-digit steals guy in his age 30 season.
Yeah. I think even if you take that away, and I think everybody's going to take that away going into next year, that, like you say, even if you factor in regression, you see the ceiling demonstrated twice in his career. You can also look at some other seasons and imagine, you know, much better results if he had been healthier. And I think you can definitely make the argument that Judge is, he should be the first player going overall next year. And I just want to just underscore something that you said at the very beginning of this conversation about how this is just a, you know, like an all-time great season. I just went back 10 years looking at offensive runs above average, and Judge already, with a little bit of time still left in the season, has the highest offensive runs above average total for the last 10 years. The next highest was Bryce Harper in 2015. And really nobody else is even close, including Mike Trout, who kind of has the rest of that leaderboard for the last 10 years. And Trout's best season was 70.5 runs. Judge's at 79.7 and counting.
We were looking at it from just a historical WAR context on rates and barrels on Monday. All time best seasons. And Aaron Judge is doing this season is like a top 50 season all time in baseball. It's in the Bonds, Ruth level of amazing seasons. You see those names at the very top of the leaderboard alongside what Aaron Judge has done here in 2022. So if you're a Yankee fan, if you've got Judge on your roster, even if you're just a fan of baseball, hopefully you're enjoying this and appreciating it for what it's really been. And the where do we go from here question is a fun question, but I think it's still going to be a very high level of production, health permitting, from Judge here in these next few seasons. I think the next logical question that we as the fantasy community often get at when someone does something like this is, who's the next Aaron Judge? Who's the next player that's going to explode for 50 plus homers and go from being a, you know, kind of a third, fourth round pick, an easy top 40 player, but someone who's going to go from top 40 to beginning of the first round? And I think my pick for that is Yordan Alvarez. He's not the second biggest barrel rate mover year over year, but he did make the cut. I was looking for guys pretty much with a 5% increase or greater, and he made that. 21% barrel rate this year. Yordan Alvarez is never, and I mean never, going to steal more than two or three bases in a season. He's never stolen two in a season before, so I think that could even be a little bit of a leap. But let's focus on what he can do and what he does do really well. This is a really great season for him. A 304, 406, 626 line. Good games played count so far. He's at 123 on the year. He's probably going to clock in right around 130, 135, depending on how much they rest him before the playoffs. That's the profile I'm looking for. If I'm trying to find the next guy that's going to jump up into that 50 home run category, even if it's only for a season, I think Alvarez shows all the traits you're looking for to do that. And I think I've had a really hard time figuring out where he's going to go in 2023 drafts. I don't know if the lack of steals will continue to give him treatments that we've seen, maybe similar to what Freddie Freeman's done, where once in a while he pops in the late first round, but a lot of times he's kind of in that pick 20 to 25 range. If that's where Yordan Alvarez is going to be on 2023 boards, I will have a lot of teams that start with probably a pitcher in the middle of round one and Yordan Alvarez, or a five-category player that I know is going to run quite a bit in the first round, plus Alvarez, and then I'll figure out the pitching from there. But I think this guy is a true first-round talent that might not be treated like one.
Yeah, I would expect the same thing, and I think either of those ways to start a draft would be excellent ways to start. And I also think that this is a great call in terms of seeing who else has this potential for an Aaron Judge 2022 type of season. Only two hitters with at least 300 batted balls had a hard hit rate above 60%, Judge and Alvarez. Only three hitters averaged at least 98 miles an hour on flies and liners in terms of exit velocity, Judge, Alvarez, and Kyle Schwarber. And those three also the only ones to have a barrel rate above 20%. So And Alvarez, you know, you add Schwarber to that equation. Well, Alvarez has the much higher ceiling in terms of batting average, especially this year with bringing that strikeout rate down, which again could regress next year. But I think that he is the next best thing to Aaron Judge.
Yeah. So count me in on Yordan Alvarez. I don't think I've ever really been out on Alvarez. Maybe some concerns after the knee surgeries, but I think he's shown enough positives on the health front to kind of put that as more of a lower risk injury profile than it was a couple of seasons ago. I think one of the most fun and challenging players to figure out in the pool right now is Jazz Chisholm, who sustained a stress fracture in his lower back earlier this year. That had already kind of pushed him out for the season. Then we found out at the end of last week that he had surgery to repair a torn meniscus in his knee, which, you know, relative to other knee surgeries is on the minor end of the scale. I think it's a shorter recovery window. I would assume that he can go through a pretty normal progression for most of the winter and he'll be ready for the start of spring training. But Chisholm made the cut for this episode because he had a 16.6% barrel rate this year. And all of these partial seasons, I think, are always challenging because for a young player especially, if he adjusted to what the league was doing to him, did the league this season have enough time to counter-adjust to what Jazz was doing? We just don't know. The K rate was slightly better than it was last year. He walked a little bit more. Part of getting to the barrel rate, you know, getting that barrel rate where it was hitting the ball in the air more consistently. And that's something he did for most of his time in the minor leagues as well. Really, that ground ball rate jumping up to 48.6%, we didn't really see that from Jazz over a full season of any of his minor league stops. I think the only exception, it was a half season he spent in rookie ball way back when he was 18. I don't think that really means a whole lot to us these days. If you kind of take the power and speed numbers, just double them up on the 60 games, he would have had 28 homers and 24 steals. That's still baking in some missed time. So there's a little bit of batting average risk. I get that. But this kind of looked like a big step forward that was muted a bit by the amount of lost time.
Yeah, and you mentioned that that doubling bakes in some potential missed time. I mean, that's really a pretty conservative estimate. Or you could, you know, also argue maybe bakes in for some variability, because Chisholm has, you know, you talked about making adjustments, and he has had those ups and downs. Where, you know, last year he started off really hot. Had a really rough stretch in the middle of the season. So who knows how the season would have progressed for Chisholm. But the whole fact that you can conservatively say that he was kind of close to a 30 25 season if he just stayed healthy all year with a reasonable batting average. And the fact that you already alluded to that the power was already there. It was just a question of just elevating the ball more. I am more encouraged than discouraged. And also the fact that he did this all this year at age 24.
I think the bet I would make also is that the Marlins have a better supporting cast around him in 2023 than they did in 2022. I don't know how much better. 5%, 10%, 20%, no idea how much that improvement's going to be, but you just get the sense they're going to put some more resources into the offense. Maybe it's a trade. I mean, we've talked about that going back to probably June of this year. The depth they have in starting pitching is something they could use to get a young, major league-ready position player, not unlike what they did to get Jazz from the Diamondbacks by flipping Zach Gallen to Arizona. So I think we're going to see more quality offensive players around Jazz in the Miami lineup next year, too. So those counting stats could tick up a little bit on a per-game basis as well. We'll monitor his health, of course, over the winter. But all of this happened early enough where I would be more optimistic than pessimistic about a pretty normal start to spring training for him in 2023. Let's get to a few more players. Cal Raleigh, frequently mentioned on the waiver episode throughout this season. I've said it on Friday, top 10 catcher for me in 2023. How about a 14.7% barrel rate? There is a little bit of batting average risk, but that lineup has already improved. He's just taken over that large share of playing time behind the plate for the Mariners. So I am definitely in on Cal Raleigh. It will likely be a pretty significant price, but I don't think it's going to be ridiculous. If he gets going around pick 150, pick 175, I think that's a fair spot to get your first catcher if you end up waiting a little bit at the position. If you miss out on JT Realmuto and Will Smith and some of the guys that are a level above him, I think Raleigh ends up being a pretty good fallback option that'll keep giving you power, even if it comes with a few limitations in the other categories. But Al, I think Cal Raleigh kind of leads us into this next group of players. I put all of the part-time players together as this big cluster. Guys that are up significantly in barrel rate, including Jake Cave, Franchy Cordero, Danny Jansen, Lars Nootbaar, Dylan Moore, Brian De La Cruz, JD Davis. All those players are up at least 5 percentage points from the previous year. JD Davis up to 16%. That's a 3.6% increase for him. So we're going to count that. And he hasn't really had an everyday job throughout this season. As you look at that group of players, it's a really odd cast. We're seeing Nootbaar play more because of trades that the Cardinals have made in that outfield, opening up some playing time, and Dylan Carlson's second half injury, I think, helped open that door as well. Who really stands out to you as players that will get a true opportunity to do it over a full season next year from this group?
I think it could be Nootbaar. I think out of this group, he is the one that strikes me as having the best opportunity to do that and to and to produce, take advantage of that opportunity. I mean, Franchy Cordero, maybe it's just hype fatigue for me, but he's now well into the post hype era, and we didn't really see. With, by the way, it was actually surprising for me to realize that Cordero got more plate appearances this year than any other previous season in his career. So with that opportunity, really didn't do a lot with it. I'd love to see Danny Jansen get more of a shot next year. Maybe it will be with another team, but I just think with Gabriel Moreno in the Blue Jays system that it's not going to happen there. And then for the other players that you mentioned, Dylan Moore, Brian De La Cruz, JD Davis, I think De La Cruz maybe has the best opportunity. Although if the Marlins do what you were saying that they will do, then yeah, I imagine that they're going to look for some more established outfielders to fill out that lineup. But maybe there's an opportunity there for De La Cruz. I don't know that his ceiling is really all that high. And Dylan Moore and JV Davis, they've been role players for a few years, and I don't really expect any different for next year.
Yeah, De La Cruz, I thought was a little bit interesting when he first started getting opportunities last season for the Marlins, and it's been a mixed bag this year. He's up to 10 homers now in 296 plate appearances. I think he hit a grand slam on Monday, if I remember correctly. So there's been encouraging progress with that barrel rate. We've seen in the past the patient eye at the plate that hasn't been as good as hoped so far in the big leagues, but he's a tricky player. I think he's the kind of guy, if you're the Marlins, You don't want to enter next season with him as a starter, but you feel okay about him as your first outfielder off the bench again. Like that, you could probably live with. Like there's enough in the profile to buy into that. Nootbaar, I think, is kind of tricky because I don't really know how long they're going to wait on Jordan Walker. We talked about Walker on one of the prospect episodes a couple weeks ago. He had a fantastic year at AA. He played a bit in the outfield this year because third base, of course, is very blocked with Nolan Arenado. So if they have designs on Jordan Walker playing on the big league roster in 2023, that could push Nootbaar back into a part-time role. So I really want to take a close look at how their offseason unfolds, but I think you're probably right that Nootbaar, if I were projecting them right now, would have the highest playing time projection as things stand here at the end of this season, looking ahead to next year. And Jansen, I think Jansen's easily good enough to start somewhere. It's a question of how much the Jays trust those young catchers between Moreno and Kirk, and whether or not they feel that trading Danny Jansen possibly helps them address a different area on the club, because he went from having good barrel rates, 8.6%, 8.5% these last two seasons, all the way up to 15.1%, does a good job not chasing pitches outside the zone. He's lowered his K rate to a career best 16.4%. I think because Alejandro Kirk is just really good as a hitter, if you don't follow the Jays or if you don't have Jansen on your roster in your fantasy league, you probably haven't noticed that this has quietly been his best all-around offensive season at the big league level. It's a 133 WRC plus, so there are plenty of teams that could look at him and say, defensively he's good, offensively he's getting better, let's make Danny Jansen a 450 plate appearance catcher. Let's make him our number one catcher if we don't have that position sorted out. So he might be a good speculative value if you're in the early part of draft season prior to that move happening. And I would say if they keep him, they probably have designs on letting him play. Like they wouldn't keep him to only use him for another 200 plate appearances next year. They'll find a way to make the pieces fit. So I think this is actually a really good spot for Danny Jansen right now.
Yeah, I agree. And in a catcher pool where things do thin out really rapidly, and even with the addition of Adley Rutschman and Raleigh, Shea Langeliers, I think that'll still be the case next year. And Jansen would be a nice catcher to kind of just, put in your back pocket, put in the queue, wait for his time to come, and could really be surprisingly productive. And I hope you're right. Get 400 plate appearances next season.
I don't know what to make of JD Davis just yet. It's only been 109 plate appearances for him with the Giants. The strikeout rate's way up, even though the O-swing percentage has gone down during that time. Barrel rate's through the roof since that trade, 26.9%. in the second half in that kind of semi-regular role. I think there's a shot he gets near everyday playing time for them. A better chance in San Francisco because of mixing and matching and not having quite as much offensive firepower in the organization right now, but they could also be big players in free agency. They could bring back Brandon Belt on a small deal at first base, and there's a lot of moving parts in the Giants offseason that could bump Davis right back into a 350 plate appearance role if the wrong moves happen and block him on the corners. But I was pretty intrigued when they made that move to get him, because I thought he was a bit of a younger version of Darren Ruff that they could still possibly tweak and improve a little bit with that swing and miss.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk about Christian Walker for a moment. He's up to 12.4% with the barrel rate this year. Did something similar back in the year of the rabbit ball in 2019. Do you think he can hold most of these gains through 2023 as that supporting cast around him has significantly improved over the course of the season.
I think most of the gains, because you can view his stat sheet a little bit in a different perspective now than coming into the season, where 2019 looked like the aberration. But now all of a sudden, last year looks like the biggest aberration, and I would expect maybe a little bit of regression from Walker. But, you know, it's encouraging that this is somebody who the first couple of months of the season was not having any kind of luck on balls in play. But the power was there. I think even the power that he was producing was not matching up to the what you might expect given his exit velocities. And so it all came together in the latter half of the season. So I have to wonder if maybe Walker will get a little underdrafted next year with people thinking he's maybe less consistent than he actually was. I would expect a little bit of regression, but he's backed it up with the peripheral stats. He's done something similar to this in a previous season. I think this is largely legit.
Yeah, he's going to have an oatmeal sort of vibe in terms of like cheap power that doesn't have another level, but that's fine. Oatmeal can win championships. Yeah. Oatmeal makes you feel full. So I think I could see another season like this. I think you're right to call back the seasons that he's done this before back in 2019. Just a fun player because he didn't get a chance to be an everyday guy in the big leagues until that age 28 season back in 2019. But that season looks a lot like this 2022 campaign, not unlike what we talked about with Aaron Judge, and he's done it with that improved K rate as well. So it's possible that the batting average will be a little bit less of a liability for him in the future than it was this year. But he could repeat what he did this year again. I think most people are going to be happy based on where he's likely to go in drafts in 2023. One more name from the big improvers group, Jock Peterson, up 5.3 percentage points, 15.4% barrel rate. He's been 10% or better each of the previous three seasons. So it's easy to see him sliding right back into that 10% range. I think the problem for me with Jock Peterson is the platoon usage. It is a clear big side platoon plan for him. There are some defensive limitations as well. And I just think those things really, they really kind of thin out his value in leagues that either don't have daily moves or leagues that aren't particularly deep, because the counting stats can lag quite a bit for a player with skills that are actually pretty good.
Yeah, I've thought of Peterson as somebody who you could just stream if he were available, or even if you had to roster him, you stream him off your bench. So he's not going to be an every week kind of player in fantasy. And the fact that he is limited to that big side platoon means that you are dealing with smaller samples from year to year. And so it just makes it all the more plausible that this year's big jump in barrel rate is going to be a little suspect going into next year, because you're not talking about the same, same quantity of plate appearances as with most of the other players that we've talked about so far.
And I think other teams are going to handle him the same way the Giants do. I don't think this is a Giants thing with Jock Peterson. I think this is just how most major league teams evaluate him as a player, and that is going to have a significant impact on what his playing time actually looks like. A few other notables that I wanted to bring up. William Contreras. We probably haven't talked as much about William Contreras on this show as we should have, just because he's had an amazing season. I mean, I didn't have William Contreras making the All-Star team. I don't know if anybody did this year, because I don't think we expected there to be enough playing time for him. 14.4% barrel rate. I'm curious what you think about Contreras, because Travis d'Arnaud is under contract for another year. He's not a bad player himself, right? I mean, this is a good catching tandem. They actually get some run occasionally outside of the catcher spot too. Playing time has been slightly in favor of d'Arnaud, but not that far from a 50-50 split. Key difference for me is there's a bit more swing and miss in Contreras' profile right now, but it's easy to see there's a pretty nice ceiling there that he could get to if playing time opens up further.
Yeah, I think that absolutely could. I'm a little suspicious of the gain in batting average this year, 278 with a 335 BABIP, with a profile that doesn't really match up with that. So I think the power is absolutely for real with Contreras, but I think you're looking at probably just a more typical catcher profile going into next year, where I would expect an average probably in the 250s. But yeah, I think with similar power, and I could see the Braves utilizing these two catchers in very much the same way that they've done this year. And I've got Darnell and Contreras on different fantasy teams and have had no problem with production or playing time for either of them. So I could see that going into next year.
Yeah, it's a rare time where two catchers sharing a role have both been productive enough to be viable in fantasy. I'm sure it's happened before, but it just doesn't happen very often, because usually if there's a share like that, the other guy is a great defender but doesn't hit. So there's a massive disparity in terms of what they provide on that side. But I'm looking at the earned values right now from the RotoWire earned value calculator, and they're both Darnell and Contreras are top 10 catchers this season. They're at 8th and 9th respectively, just ahead of Cal Raleigh, MJ Melendez, Adley Rutschman in terms of their value for the season, just behind Alejandro Kirk and Salvador Perez. So I think they will be somewhat tough to rank, just because when you're slicing away playing time compared to a lot of those other players that are in that range right now, they're not going to stack up as favorably. I'm with you on lowering the expectation average-wise for William Contreras. I do think there's a few reasons long-term to think he can still improve, though, given his age and limited experience in the big leagues. He's at 519 career plate appearances, 28.3% K rate, but he's lowered his O-swing percentage to 31.3%. Nice improvement from last year at 35.6%. And we've seen in the upper levels of the minor leagues, K rates right around and even below 20%. So even if it's 24-25% at the big league level, given the difference in the quality of pitching at this level versus lower levels, that's another handful of balls in play where some good things can happen given how much hard contact he makes. But I think you're absolutely right to set that expectation closer to 250 than the 278 that he's hitting right now. But I find that playing time situation to be fascinating. And maybe Contreras is the smarter way to go, just given the unfortunate injury history of Travis Darnell. He's had a lot of wear and tear that he's accumulated over the course of his career. David Peralta is actually on this list as a barrel rate riser. I did not see that coming. usually lives in the 5% range. We haven't seen a ton of power from him, just 12 homers. That's kind of typical for David Peralta. I don't really know what to make of him as a player at this stage of his career. It's coming from more fly balls. 35.9% ground ball rate is easily the lowest of his career. We've seen a hard hit rate similar to what he's doing this year. So these skills didn't come out of nowhere, but it looks like a late career adjustment to his approach or his swing that has enabled him to get a little more loft consistently.
It's disappointing that that hasn't translated into a higher home run tally. He's just got 12 at this point with very little time left in the season. And I don't know what sort of role he's going to find himself in 2023. So I would absolutely anticipate that Peralta's going to be undrafted for the most part in 12-team leagues. Maybe this is something that he can build on next year. I mean, it happens. There's somebody's got to be the outlier, and maybe it's Peralta, where he hits more fly balls and has a spike in his barrel rate, and yet, it doesn't really show up in any kind of actual increased power production. So maybe that's something that corrects itself next year, but first he has to get the opportunity to play regularly.
It's just weird. 11.6% was his barrel rate before the trade to Tampa Bay, 3.9% after the trade. 12 homers with Arizona, 0 in Tampa Bay. Very, very strange. And he is getting to the point in his career. I know he made the move to the outfield a little bit later and had some major injuries. Really fascinating story when he broke into the league. David Peralta is 35 years old, so it might be a non-guaranteed or a one-year deal and has to earn playing time in the spring as we look ahead to next year. Nick Gordon is a big riser, 10.2% barrel rate, and I think there is a chance that because of his defensive versatility, he could be an everyday player for the Twins, even if he doesn't have one spot on the depth chart to call his own going into the start of next season.
Yeah. He's really positioned himself well to have that kind of role next year. And another player, much like Peralta, where you figure he should be hitting more home runs than he actually has. He only has 9 home runs and 388 plate appearances. So I feel a little bit vindicated and validated by the X stats, because X slugging has him at 486. So I think it's about 40 points higher than his actual slugging. So I think that Gordon has that versatility where he can get the playing time, and he's got the skill set that he showed this year to hit the ball really hard and hit it high enough, often enough, that you could see a good deal more power next year. I'm thinking maybe there's 20 home runs in him somewhere.
Yeah, I'm looking at the overall numbers for his career. He's at 604 career plate appearances. It's taken him 198 games to get there because he doesn't start every day. At least he didn't to begin his career. But 13 homers, 16 steals in 21 attempts, 264, 313, 412 for the slash line. You know, if that's the floor, that's still a very solid player in our current run environment. And in a 15-team league especially, given the multi-position eligibility, probably a good player to have as your first guy off the bench. That would be sort of the ideal spot, or maybe as your, you know, your last outfielder. It is important, though, especially this time of year as you're starting to get ready for draft prep for next season, double-check all of the games played by positions for multi-position eligible players, because position eligibility could be lost in some instances. Fortunately for Gordon, 92 games in the outfield this year, 26 games at second base. So he's got those two spots. If your league uses 10 for a cutoff at shortstop or 15, you're good because he's played 16 there. He might not get to 20, though, if your league requires 20. So slightly less versatility, even though playing time looks like it's going to be pretty solid for Nick Gordon. And he could gain positions back, too, depending on what changes on that roster for the Twins between now and next season. One other notable name on the positive side, Eloy Jimenez, 15.7% barrel rate, up nearly 5 percentage points from last year, and just seeing big movement in the right direction here during an injury-plagued season actually has me interested in taking one more shot next year, even though I think the health grade on the A to F scale is probably a D-plus right now for Eloy Jimenez.
Yeah, I mean, the last 2 years combined, you know, barely more than 500 plate appearances. So, you know, two full seasons combined. But this, yeah, the improvement in skills, which also include a decrease in strikeout rate, super encouraging. I'm sure he's going to get discounted because of health. And if that does happen, then I probably will wind up with Jimenez on several rosters next year, because if he does happen to put something close to a whole season together, he's going to win some leagues.
The 30 home runs he hit back as a rookie in 2019, I don't think that was just the byproduct of the rabbit ball that year. Yeah. I mean, that's legit power. And I guess if you're looking for the knockoff version, or the, I don't know, I would say the TJ Maxx version. I buy clothes there. This is not a judgment of all. But if you're looking for that version of Yordan Alvarez, the guy that's going to go even later, that could shoot way up in terms of power, I think Eloy still has enough good things in the profile where you're not wrong to believe that he could take a big step forward like that. Maybe 35 to 40 home runs is actually in play if, it's a big, big if they can keep him on the field for a full season or close to it. 145 games might be kind of a high-end expectation for him, given what's happened these last two seasons. Let's go the other direction. Let's take a look at some fallers. And I think, as you said up top, it's easier to find the reasons why players dropped off. Known injuries. Several catchers, too. Mike Zunino, Mitch Garver, Yasmani Grandal, all way down in barrel rates this year. And I think, given their respective ages and the nature of the position, the wear and tear that some of those guys have had, your interest level in seeing and buying in for a bounce back probably varies a lot compared to other players that we're going to talk about. I look at that group of three and I say, yeah, maybe if the price is just really low and I'm kind of desperate at catcher, I'm interested in almost any of them. Zunino might be the exception. I think he had the most severe of the injuries. I think there's also a wider range of outcomes to the downside with him that we've seen already before. Whereas someone like Grandal, I think when he's healthy, tends to run pretty good. It tends to be a 230, good OBP guy with legit power. I'm just wondering if we're at the point with Grandal now where multiple years of injuries piling up on top of general wear and tear being a catcher means the bounce back's just not going to be nearly as good as it might have been a few seasons ago.
I think a lot of people will just make that assumption that that's the case. And I'm projecting here because I feel that way. So I could see Grandal really dropping a lot next year. And then, yeah, like you said, you need to pick up a number two catcher. At least there is that upside that Grandal can get back to where he had been previously. And same with Garver, too. So hopefully they come back healthier next year. But I agree with you on Zunino, that even the really best version of Zunino has really major downside in terms of batting average that I won't say it cancels out the appeal that his power brings, but it definitely limits his value.
Now, the other player that was in the known injuries group for me, and there's other guys that have been hurt with at least minor injuries that we're going to get to, Alex Kirilloff in Minnesota, 6.3% barrel rate. Didn't spend that much time in the big leagues this year, only 45 games, was 155 plate appearances, spent almost the same amount of time, playing time-wise, at AAA St. Paul, and looked like a great player at AAA. It's a level he really didn't spend time at previously. So when you look at Kirilloff and you think about the wrist injury that ended his season, he had surgery that shortened the ulnar bone in his right wrist and cleaned up some scar tissue that ended his season, what are you expecting for next season? Given his age, I think it's easier to have some optimism about the health taking a step in the right direction. I imagine we're getting, I don't know, a 100-pick discount at least off of the ADP from 2022 when he was a back-of-the-top 200 sort of player. And I wouldn't say the upside has necessarily vanished in this case.
No, it hasn't vanished. It's just that the risk is greater, especially with him coming off of a wrist injury. You have to be prepared that if you get Kirilloff, and I think you're probably right in terms of where to expect him for ADP. And so you're not taking a big risk, but when you do roster Kirilloff, you just have to be prepared to be very patient and maybe not cut him too soon, because you don't want somebody else to get the benefit of the upside that he did display at AAA this year. So, I think our best hope in terms of, for approaching him in fantasy is that he does get that discount, and seems very likely that he would.
Definitely some platoon risk, at least big side platoon risk, though, too, depending on how all the pieces fit on that roster for the Twins.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Among the stars with the biggest drop-offs, Ronald Acuna Jr., he's talked about his knee just not feeling great post-surgery. I think that was just a few weeks ago that he made those comments, so it wasn't like it was something he said right after coming back and hasn't talked about since. I totally get it. This is a major injury. Came back pretty quickly. A 12.9% barrel rate actually matches his 2019 mark. It's down 7.4% from the pre-injury 2021 numbers. Are you buying into Acuna going through a period of rest this offseason and then kind of progressing the way he ordinarily would to be a clear first rounder again? Like, I think we still see a lot of flashes of that player, even though he's been playing at some level clearly below 100%.
Yeah, and that explains some of what would, I think, be fair to call a disappointing performance. But I think this is another player, too, where you look at the barrel rate and you look at the expected slugging, 493, when he's actually slugged 420 so far. And I think that you can expect some combination of improvement, both because of being healthier next year and also just, I think, some improvement that's naturally going to come, because this is just not a player who profiles as a 149 ISO player. I mean, he should be putting up like a 200 plus ISO at least. Which again, that would put him closer to where he was at as a rookie.
Yeah, projections for the rest of season, just for the slash line, are in the kind of 270 range at the higher end. Usually the 360s for the OBP, and the BatX actually has a 513 slugging percentage. It's a pretty big step ahead of where he is right now with the slugging percentage in particular. You could tell me the first two numbers of that slash line are the sort of new baseline, but the thing that surprised me the most with Acuña, especially knowing now that he doesn't feel that great, he's 28 for 39 as a base stealer in 108 games. He's running a lot, running basically at the same rate, if not even slightly more, than he was running all the way back in 2019. So I'm still pretty optimistic here. He's also hitting the ball on the ground a lot. Like, I think that's pretty surprising and not really who he is. I just think his foundation as a hitter is just not right with that knee coming off of surgery. But I do think time can be very beneficial for him to get back closer to the player that he was prior to suffering that injury. So he's a first rounder for me, maybe middle of the first round. But I think the skills are still good enough overall to be optimistic with Acuña. George Springer down quite a bit, 8.2% barrel rate. It does seem like the bumps and bruises have really started to pile up on Springer in recent years. Missed a lot of time last year. I think it was a quad or a hamstring injury, if I remember correctly. He's probably going to clock in around 130 games played by the end of this regular season, which is not bad. The stolen bases have actually come back. He's 13 for 14 as a base dealer. He's got his highest stolen base total since 2015, and he's been efficient with that too. So a nice pleasant surprise for a guy who's 33 years old now after just having a birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, George. What do you make of the barrel rate falling off?
I'm not really sure, but I'm prepared to take the risk that this isn't, you know, the beginning of a long steady decline, but maybe just something of an outlier. It's easy to, I think, make that assumption that it's just the injuries are just piling up and affecting him, but I don't know. It's a really big decrease from previous years, and 3 years in a row prior to this one where he had an ISO of at least 275 or higher. So to be at just 195, especially with the home park that he's got, it does feel like maybe an outsized correction more than we should really be expecting. So I would expect at least a mild rebound for Springer next year.
Yeah, I think we're going to get a bit of a discount on draft day, even though the speed has shown up. I think there's going to be a lot of pessimism because of his age, and maybe he falls into that old, boring, undervalued group, and that can be a really good place to get players that end up giving you a big boost this year. So I don't see anything on the surface that explains the full extent of that drop-off from Springer. So I would expect at least a little bit of a bounce back going into next season. And there's so many ways that the supporting cast can just kind of help keep him afloat, even if he is in the beginning of a late career downturn. As long as he's playing every day in Toronto, it's going to be a pretty graceful decline. I think the way his skills have developed over time compared to where he was as a prospect, I am so much more confident in the player George Springer became as a big leaguer aging gracefully than I was in the player he was back when he was a prospect aging gracefully. He was really more of that three true outcome sort of player. The K rate was a lot higher. I just thought, oh, okay, if he's going to swing and miss like that, as toolsy as he is, this isn't going to work out particularly well in the long run. He's changed a lot about that. I mean, the K rate's down again, 17.5%. He's done that several times in his career, so we're not seeing a major spike there. A few more swings and misses outside the zone, but this is not an alarming shift. It's just one particular thing that's not been there at the level we expected. I guess the ground ball rate, there's a big spike there, but compared to his career norms, that's still not bad. 45.6% is almost identical to what he's done for his big league career. So I'm cautiously optimistic with Springer, and the cautious nature of my optimism is really just based on the fact that he is 33 years old now. Tyler O'Neill, 11.3% for the barrel rate this year, down 6.6%. He was hurt. He's healthy now. Playing time share should be massive heading into next season, Al. He's got power. He's got speed. He's probably coming at a discounted price. It's a strong lineup, as we've seen throughout this year. is there any reason why I shouldn't be in on a Tyler O'Neill bounce back?
I don't think so. If I'm ready for Springer to have at least a partial rebound, there's absolutely no reason to be thinking that this is just going to be a new level for Tyler O'Neill. It's a bit perplexing. So no, I think he'll be discounted next year and well worth wherever he does wind up going.
Nagging leg injuries this year. The hamstring has him back on the IL right now. Even around that, 14 for 18 is a base stealer in 96 games. So taking off a bit more than he did last year with the power being down. I don't look at Tyler O'Neill and say, oh yeah, that guy's not going to hit for power. How could you come to that conclusion when you look at that guy? Like it's going to be there. And even with all the struggles this year, still putting together what has amounted to a league average line, even though it's been disappointing based on draft day costs. So count me in for a discount. Probably somewhere in that pick 100 range is where I'd be very comfortable taking Tyler O'Neill looking ahead to next season. Here's another Marlin, Avisail Garcia. And he has been one of the biggest fallers production-wise of anybody in the pool. It's a 6.3% barrel rate. He has a lot of year-to-year fluctuations. If you look over the last few seasons for him, Garcia was at 10.6% in 2019, dropped down to 3.8% in the shortened season, spiked back up to 12.2% during his final year with the Brewers in 2021, and then fell to 6.3% this year with the Marlins. Playing time should be really stable, though, because he's still early in a multi-year deal. I can't imagine they would bench him. We're talking about a player who's got 3 years, I think, left on his deal with the Marlins. Yeah, it's 4 for 53. So you're probably not sitting him down in year two. And perhaps there's some adjustments he has to make during the offseason. But I think this is a true like buy lowest or buy ugliest sort of scenario where you might get a boatload of playing time and counting stats for rock bottom prices.
Yeah, I really do not know how to understand this season for Garcia. It looked like middle of the year he was starting to come around a little bit. But even though, yeah, he's had some inconsistency before, it's easy enough to kind of write off the 2020 season, which was not only short, but just, you know, the circumstances were just bizarre. It would seem like it would be easy to just figure somehow he's going to get back to being a 20 home run presence next year for the Marlins. And you're right. I mean, the playing time is going to be there as long as he's healthy. So I'm just going to just toss this season out the window when I look at him for next year, because I don't even know how to begin to make sense of it. Everything was off for him, not just the power.
Might be a bench outfielder for a 15-team mixed league who ends up playing a lot for you. Draft and hold, I think, is a good pick for those formats. NL-only leagues definitely works there. I don't know if I want him in like a 10 or a 12-team league because the ceiling isn't necessarily high enough, but plenty of ways that he could actually rebound in 2023. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., all the way down to 3.8%. This one might be another injury situation. It's a massive drop compared to his previous norms, and I didn't really see any sort of warning signs here. I think the key is that if it's injuries he's mostly played through so far. And if you have him, you're getting average and some run production, but we're talking about a guy that hit 21 homers last year that's sitting on 5 through 121 games this season.
Yeah. And that's, you know, 21 homers after an 11 homer season in the short season, 20 homers and a relatively limited number of games the year before that. So it's a player who's just too young to be falling off the map like this, a few years younger even than Garcia. So this makes even less sense to me. It's obviously a great situation for Gurriel. So, I would expect better things from him next year, maybe a lot better.
He might be draftable still. Gurriel might be draftable in a 12-team league as your last hitter. I think there's enough ceiling with him, given the lineup especially. The counting stats could pop. Power gets back to the 20 range, and the average is still good. All those things could actually make him relevant in those more shallow formats. So, yeah, I think there's going to be a pretty big difference in price between Gurriel and Garcia, but I think they're similarly disappointing as guys that I just didn't see a lot of reason to avoid them going into 2022. Josh Donaldson down to a 10.6% barrel rate. It's a massive drop for him. Is he finally just going through a normal age-related decline at this point?
Well, that's how I'm reading it. And so, you know, maybe it's a little too easy, but That's how I'll read it for Donaldson, whereas I'm willing to give a lot of benefit of the doubt to Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and even obviously Al Garcia, who's on the downslope, but just not as far along. So, I won't be looking for Donaldson next year. Do you see anything there? Because I just think that the age narrative just explains too much here.
I think if you want to treat him the way that you looked at Evan Longoria going into this season, for any format where Longoria was useful, I think that's about the extent to which I'm interested in Donaldson. I don't think we're getting a shallow mixed league level sort of return from him again. I do think even as we've seen in recent years, 2021, the per game production was good, but it was still only 135 games. And it's hard to count on him for more than that. He's going to come close to that number this year. The hard hit rate is way down, so the supporting quality of contact underneath the barrel rate has taken a massive hit. He's going to be 37 in December. I think he's just more of a draft and hold sort of filler. The reason why I think the playing time is still somewhat safe, he's on a last year of a big contract, so I don't think he's going to disappear completely, but I think if you're expecting him to bounce back to the player he was on a per-game basis even a year ago, you're probably expecting a little bit too much from Donaldson. We talked about Javier Baez on our episode last week. He's way down in barrel rate. Not a big surprise to see the drop off there, given the other issues that Baez has dealt with this season. But how about Jonathan India, who also has dealt with a lot of injuries? I think this is a little bit like the Tyler O'Neill case, where after missing a lot of time earlier in the year, we're finally getting a look at India throughout the second half. I actually liked him at the price during draft season. A lot of times breakout players like this the year before end up being too expensive. I did not think that was the case with Jonathan India. I imagine we're getting a discount of some kind going into 2023 drafts. If India is sitting there in the pick 130, pick 150 range, I think that actually is a good all-round value play at second base, because I think they're going to give him every opportunity to stay high up in that order and remain an everyday player as they go through that rebuild in Cincinnati.
Yeah, being in a rebuild, I think that India should be a central player in the Reds offense next year. So he's certainly young enough to rebound. Health is really the only question, and the role also should just not be any concern going into next year. Should be right in either at the top or right in the middle of that order.
Yeah, so the counting stats might not be as good as they were in 2021, given all the moving parts there, but I do think the slash line can get a lot closer to what we saw in Jonathan India's rookie season. A few part-timers that made this list: Akil Baddoo. I just didn't see a collapse like this coming. Luis Torrens, who really is just going to need a trade given the Cal Raleigh breakout. Aristides Aquino, who we've talked about on the waiver show, I believe on Friday. This looks like maybe it's his last prolonged run as a semi-regular, happening right before our very eyes. And then Sam Hilliard, a sleeper from draft seasons past. I think I'm finally ready to give up on Sam Hilliard. Of that group, I mean, Baddoo, because he's the youngest, seems like the guy that I would still hold out some hope for, but is there anything I'm overlooking for the other three players?
I don't think so. You'd mentioned that we had talked about Aquino on Friday's show, and the context for that discussion was that he's finally bringing the strikeout rate down quite a bit. It's in limited plate appearances, so I think what Aquino can do over the remainder of the season is going to be something that we should watch. I wouldn't totally write him off yet, but I am with you on not really holding out much hope for Sam Hilliard at this point. Luis Torrens, maybe change of scenery gives him a chance to make good on his potential. And with Baddoo, I think it depends on what direction the Tigers go next year. It wouldn't totally shock me to see them maybe move on a Rule 5 player that maybe they just figure didn't work out this year, but it really depends on how aggressive they are in the off season. But I'd certainly like to see Baddoo get another chance with them or somebody else, given how surprisingly good he was as a rookie.
Yeah, Baddoo, he hadn't really spent time at AAA because of the injury that he had in 2019 High A, tore up his knee. Then he was a Rule 5 pick. 2020 lost minor league season because of the pandemic. All that weird stuff happened, and then, of course, came up, showed power, showed speed, held his own, more than held his own as a big league player last year, got that quick demotion to begin this year, played well at AAA while he was down there this year. Akil Baddoo only had 30 games at AAA Toledo. He popped three homers, stole seven bases. It was a .300, .405, .500 line. He's only 23. Well, he turned 24 just a few weeks ago. So this is age 23 season, just based on how we talk about these things. I'd be stunned if they gave up on him. I think if the Tigers gave up on Badu, somebody else would be eager to give him an opportunity. I think it would make a lot of sense, just given the way that he controlled the strike zone pretty well last year. Didn't really look like the kind of player you'd expect for someone who had never played above the high A level upon arrival last season. So I'm cautiously optimistic here that they'll actually keep him and give him at least big side platoon opportunities with that power-speed combo that might actually play pretty well. A few other notables, Aaron Hicks. I thought Aaron Hicks was a great bounce-back candidate this year because I've always looked at him as a bit of an underrated player, maybe someone whose batting average makes us overlook the things he does well, even though he gets on base at a high clip, can be in a prominent spot in a good lineup when things are going well, has some power, has some speed. But now if you look, this is another year where the slugging percentage has been in the low 300 range. Barrel rate underneath it isn't good. What are you doing with Aaron Hicks as you move forward?
Pretty much ignoring him next year. I do think that this is another player where I think age is a factor that you can take seriously. And he's just dropped down into a territory where I don't think there's much appeal.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. Maybe mono leagues, but that's about it for Aaron Hicks at this point. Nelson Cruz way down. I think he's finally going to ride off into the sunset. Not a big surprise to see the barrel rate sitting at 9.3%. I think the writing was sort of on the wall when he was not traded at the deadline, right? If there was a contending team that saw him as an upgrade to possibly help their bench or their DH spot, that would have happened. Ian Happ, who's actually had a very good year, down in barrel rate? That's pretty odd, right? 7.1% is the number, and actually 7 even since I made the list on Monday and they played yesterday, but a 7% barrel rate after running double-digit barrel rates in each of his previous 5 seasons. We're seeing Happ continue to walk. We're seeing him lower his K rate to a career best 23.8%. He's still running a little bit. I see a lot more good than bad here. This just looks like a little bit of a blip on the radar in terms of barrel rate.
I think so. I mean, you have to figure at least there'd be a partial rebound, maybe, you know, goes halfway back to his previous level. But given where he's at in his career and on the age curve, that I could see him going all the way back. And I'm not exactly sure what happened this year. Like you said, it's been a pretty good season. I was very surprised to see Happ on this list. And I'm not, I'll look into it a little bit and try to better understand this. But I think I'm probably not going to be convinced that he's any worse of a player than he was 12 months ago.
He looks like a more consistent player now with this profile than he did at other points in his career. One last player to get to, a bit of a long episode today. Ozzie Albies, 5.4% barrel rate, back on the IL with a fractured pinky finger. So 2 major injuries, only 64 games in the regular season. It's a 247, 294, 409 line. I think there's going to be an assumption that had he been healthy, Albies would have come back closer to his previous career norms. He's been a challenging player really kind of throughout his career, though, because for an early draft pick, he does not have the slash line that you would typically expect. It's a low OBP player that often goes early because he plays every single day. He gets to plenty of power, 20 or more homers in three of his seasons, and those were really the only full seasons he's played, and he runs at least 14 steals in each of those seasons, including a 20 for 24 mark last year for Atlanta. So how concerned are you about Albies, given the past success he's had with this profile in the face of a drop-off in barrel rate in this partial season?
It really depends on ADP. So, I mean, I would be concerned if he doesn't get discounted and he's still right at the top of the second base rankings for ADP, because I agree with you. I feel like because he does have that speed power combination, that Albies gets a little bit overdrafted and overrated each year. Now that he's coming off of a season where he has had to deal with injuries and the power hasn't been there quite at the same level whereas in the past, maybe I would have gone with the crowd and taken the risk on Albies at a higher ADP. Going into next year, if that doesn't change, I probably wind up not having him rostered anywhere.
Trying to think of a similar young player consistently going as high as Albies has gone, His ADP in April for those last handful of drafts that we had before the season started, his ADP was 17. It was going that early. So I think in terms of a discount, we're probably talking about pick 40, pick 50, just because the guys that go that early can only fall so far. So I think I'm in at that much of a discount, even with some of the limitations he's shown. That's a massive playing time share in a great lineup where he does all the things we care about well, with maybe the exception of batting average in a down year, but he's even flashed the ability to be good in that category when things break right. So I think I'm in on Albies if it ends up being that kind of pick 40, pick 50 range sort of discount. If it's less of a discount than that, it's much less of a lock for me to have him on a bunch of teams.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to draw the line. And if he falls to there, especially given the options at second base, then yeah, that's an ADP that I could live with for Albies.
Long offseason just around the corner to debate it and think about it. But we figure it's always a good time to check in on players that we haven't talked about a lot. It's what we've been doing here for these last few weeks. If you got questions for a future episode, hit us up on Twitter. You can find Al at AlMelchiorBB. You can get me at Derek Van Riper. If it's for the pod, just make a note that it's for the pod, not just a question that you're hoping to have answered sort of immediately. If you need to get a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/fantasybaseballpodcast. That's going to do it for this episode of the Athletic Fantasy Baseball Podcast. We're back with you on Wednesday with Under the Radar.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.